From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to the weekend. Give yourselves a little pat on the back. Coming up in today's show, we will hear from Michael Grey Eyes. He's an actor in the Peacock show, Rutherford Falls, and he's going to talk about what makes it so good.
This is a smart show. A really, really smart show. Like, I think humor is awareness, but this show always surprises me with how deep it is.
But first, it's our chat about the week that was. Our guests this week are the co-hosts of New York Magazine's The Cut podcast, Jasmine Aguilera and B.A. Parker. Jasmine, hey.
Hi.
Parker, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you.
I have to apologize because there's a garbage truck stalled in front of my apartment. I don't.
Oh,
you
I hear that.
That?
I do.
I want to apologize.
It is not your fault, Parker.
For New York City as a whole.
I bet that's driving you insane, and I'm sorry to hear it, but I think we should just charge ahead. Okay, so this was, I think it's fair to say, a very interesting week. We found out we're not going to get to President Biden's goal of 70% of the American population receiving at least one vaccine by the 4th of July. The New York City Democratic mayoral primary is too close to call, but we know Andrew Yang isn't going to make it. Netflix has a new reality dating show where all the contestants have prosthetics that make them look like cast members of Cats.
I like your fin.
But we are not going to talk about any of that stuff. I think we should start instead with Britney Spears. She spoke at a court hearing this week about her conservatorship. This is something we've talked about on this show before. Essentially, the pop star's personal and professional life have been under the control of her estranged father since 2008. At the hearing, she spoke publicly about the details of the conservatorship, which she called abusive. She's requesting that it be dissolved. Lots of people were on the edges of their seats following this, at least based on my Twitter feed. There were some very haunting details. I'm curious if y'all tuned in. Jasmine, were you following this closely?
Yeah, I was following it, especially because I know a couple people that worked on the documentary that came out.
Right. You're talking about Framing Britney Spears, the New York Times documentary.
So, like, just following and revisiting that whole saga has been just, I don't even know if like mind blowing is the right word, but just heartbreaking, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it is like, I don't know, there's so much to wrap your head around where it's just like, how is this even real? You know, like it just doesn't make sense that it's a thing that could happen in the year of our Lord 2021. You know what I mean?
It's also crazy that the idea, it challenges the idea that if enough people know about a problem that it will get fixed, because everyone knows about this, and yet here we are still. You know, you think that like with enough outrage, there'll be some kind of movement. And maybe this is what that is. Maybe.
Well, and there is a Free Britney movement. And I do think you probably could argue that the Free Britney movement has something to do with her standing up for herself now. I don't know. What do you think, Parker?
I think that what got me was just how haunting it was, like the details of it and just, you know, having people outside of yourself being in control of like your reproductive rights and your ability to like get married and just to have a life is so horrifying.
Yeah.
You're referring to the fact that she testified that she wanted to get her IUD removed and couldn't, which is just like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
And one thing she said yesterday was, all I want is to own my money for this to end and my boyfriend to drive me in his car, which is like, not, doesn't seem like too much to ask.
It's like the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Of a girl, of a 40-year-old woman.
Yeah. Again, in the year 2021, you know, like it just is astounding.
Yeah.
So, staying with the legal world, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the United States Supreme Court, which, I don't know, I feel like these days, speaking of, you know, the right to choose or whatever, often cases these days can be super dire. But I found this story to be oddly refreshing. Turns out back in 2017, teenager Brandy Levy took a Snapchat to express her frustration at not making the varsity squad. She was a cheerleader. She said, fuck the school, fuck cheer, fuck everything. And she got kicked off the team and she sued. And the controversy has made it all the way to the highest court in the land. And this week, 8 justices agreed with Brandy that free speech is free speech as long as it doesn't disrupt the classroom. I am just so delighted by this. I'm curious for both of you, like, is there something equivalent that you might have been suspended for? I mean, partly why I think I find this so delightful is, like, I also am, like, filled with relief by the fact that Snapchat didn't exist when I was 17. So I just, like, didn't even have the possibility of saying fuck everything on a public platform. But I don't know. Yeah, it got me wondering, like, is there something that, thinking about now, if you had said it on Snapchat, you probably would have gotten kicked off the cheerleading squad?
Oh, boy.
That's more of a Jasmine question.
Oh, you know me so well, Parker.
I had a feeling Jasmine was going to have a good one for
this.
Yeah,
no, I have many. I was actually, like, struggling to pick one. I had an attitude in high school. Well, first of all, this whole story is such a mood. It's such a mood. And also, like, the cojones to, like, take it all the way to Supreme Court. Like, good on you, girl.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she might as well have said, fuck the Supreme Court, you know?
Yeah, really. Well, when I read this story, I immediately thought of this picture that exists. Me and my best friend in senior year of high school, we took a picture of us flipping off the, like, SoCal High School, which is the name of my high school, like, sign in our graduation robes.
Okay.
Just as, like, a, you know, whatever. And I had already graduated, right? They'd already given me my diploma. And afterwards, they saw it on MySpace, because that's how old I am. And I got like called in, because, you know, you have the last day of school and you have graduations after school ends, right? Uh-huh. So they still called in the summer, and they were like, you need to take this down. And I was like,
wow.
I was like, what are you gonna do, take my diploma? I already have it. So like no. So I didn't really do anything about it, but they tried, and I think ultimately they realized that they were gonna, like, lose that battle. And I think that they were a little bit more willing to let me be me because I did, like, the morning announcements. And I was, like, kind of, like, one of those kids that was really active in a lot of different clubs and a lot of weird stuff. But I also just had, like, I had an attitude. I was constantly, like, doing protests in the quad and, like, you know, doing stuff like that. So they can't control me. Can't be controlled.
I love that. What do you think, Parker? Is there anything in your sordid past?
Oh, mine was protest related. When I was like, oh God, it's going to sound bad when you say it out loud. Like right after 9/11, when I was like 14, I guess, I made a t-shirt, like patriotism got a little too rough.
Yeah.
And so I made a t-shirt at school that said, I'm afraid of Americans.
Wow.
And I got detention for it. And then one of my favorite teachers was in charge of the detention, and she was like, she taught me how to protest. So she was like, I'm not implementing this detention, just get out.
Oh, good.
Yeah, like she was one of those people that was like, use the school computers to look up anything unsavory in case the government's looking. She helped me make like impeach Bush posters. Like I that was my bag. I wasn't really a curse person. I wasn't really I didn't say bad words a lot until I moved to New York.
I feel like the most I got in trouble was probably in junior high, and I had pneumonia, so I couldn't be in gym class. So I like spent that period in the library, and I was talking to a friend in the library, and the librarian told us to shush. And I mouthed "what a bitch" at my friend who I was talking to, which is funny to think about because it's such an obvious, like, you don't have to say the words. It's very clear if you're mouthing "what a bitch." And like the librarian saw me, and then she gave me detention. And I feel very, as a book and librarian lover now, I feel very bad that I, you know, was so mean to the librarian.
Aww.
One thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately that I'm curious to ask you two about is online dating. I feel like we are, like, quote unquote post-pandemic enough that, like, people are getting back on the apps and doing the thing. I am still extremely reticent about the entire process.
Hide.
Jasmine, I know you did an episode not specifically about online dating, but at least about dating. Are you back on the apps? Are you doing this thing?
Oh, girl, I've been on the apps.
Really? The whole time?
Yeah.
Wow.
I have I need a therapist.
That's funny because I talked to my therapist last week and she was like, yeah, don't do it. You're not ready yet. And I was like, thank you, therapist.
My therapist did the same thing. She was like, also just like, just maybe not date guys in New York. Don't you visit Baltimore a lot? Why don't you try there?
I mean, that seems like it's probably pretty good advice too. So Jasmine, do you have any highlights? Anything that will make like affirm Parker's in my decision? Gosh.
Where do I begin? Well, I had one guy show up at my house high on cocaine.
Oh my God. Wow.
He didn't tell me. And I was like, is he nervous? He was just like, I'm talking really fast. Blah, 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 blah. And he was just like going on about his whole life when I was like, how are you? Bam. His whole life story. And like at 1.5 speed or something. And then in the middle of it, I was like, are you okay? And he was like, I'm sorry, I took like a bump before I got here because I was so nervous. And like, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay. Wow. So that's a winner.
So you're engaged now?
Yeah, exactly. Now we're going to get married. Yeah, no, it's been trash. I've made the revelation recently that I'm going to get off of them. And now that everything is opening up, I'm actually going to try to do it organically again.
Yeah.
I've never had a relationship work out for like longer than like a couple months that started on a dating app. But the ones that start organically, even if the person is like not as much of my type, like even if they're, you know, not exactly what I want, I still find myself wanting them more because the context of how we met feels more like a romantic storyline that I'm more invested in than like we both wanted to foot, you know.
Well, I like the idea of real life. Do you have any strategies for that I should be doing? Probably staying up past 9 p.m., huh?
Well, that, and I honestly, I've just embraced shamelessness. I just like, I just go right up to people and go, hey, I think you're really hot. Like, are you here with anybody? I did that over the weekend to somebody.
Did it work?
No, I got cock-blocked. It would have worked. I was at a karaoke place and this girl was there. She was so fine. And I just like walked up to her and I put my hand on her knee. She was fine with it. And I said, you are so hot. Like, are you here with anybody? And she's like, no, I'm not. And I'm like, okay. But then she was kind of like flirting with a bunch of different people. And I asked her friend who was with her. I was like, is she gay? And she was like, yeah, she's bi. And I was like, great. Like, I'm going to try. And then like I sang, I touched myself. Up on me and she started dancing on me, like grinding up on me while I was singing.
Okay.
And I was like, all right, green light, go. And then she grabbed my hand after I was done. She's like, let's go take some shots at the bar. And I'm like, all right. And we walked right up to the bar, and then two dudes that I was there with, like I was there as a big party, they came in, swooped in on either side and completely cock blocked me. I was like, hey. And I literally put my hand on one of their chests and like pushed them away, and I was like, no, this is why I'm trying here. And I was unsuccessful. I was very frustrated. So,
oh, Jasmine.
That was an admirable attempt, though.
I respect the game. I respect the game.
You just got to try it. You can't be afraid of rejection.
Okay. This is helpful. This is very helpful. Parker, what do you think?
I got nothing for you, Greta. The dating apps are awful. Like, for me, men don't know how to talk to chubby black girls with like some kind of common sense. Mm-mm. So, like, I think one of the more successful interactions, I was like on Bumble or whatever, and the guy, I said hi, and the guy went, name the five ways that you're useful.
Jesus Christ.
What?
Oh my God. Oh my God. Were you like, fuck school, fuck cheer, fuck you? Parker, Jasmine, thank you both so much. Y'all are the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Greta.
In just a minute, Michael Gray Eyes is going to give you approximately 1 million reasons why you should watch Rutherford Falls, the newest show from Mike Schur. Our guest today is an actor on one of the best shows I have seen so far this year. It's called Rutherford Falls. It's on Peacock, and it's the latest show from Mike Schur, who's behind Parks and Rec and The Good Place and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Ed Helms from The Office is in it, but as you'll find out in this interview, there is a lot more to it than that. First, though, here's what the show is about. Ed Helms plays Nathan Rutherford. He's the descendant of the guy who founded this town, Rutherford Falls, on Native land. Nathan's best friend is Regan, who's played by Janice Schmieding, who's amazing. She's a member of the fictional Minnishanka Nation, and she works for Terry Thomas, who owns the casino in town. Terry is played by Michael Greyeyes, who's Plains Cree, and he is with us now. Michael, welcome to Nerdette.
Hi there. Hi, Greta.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you. So obviously, those were just like the barest of plot points that I just gave. I think the show does a lot. It speaks to a lot of conversations that people are having around reckonings with legacies and identities. I think it's also largely about friendship and community and ambition. I'm curious what stood out to you when you first heard about it.
To me, this is a really beautiful examination of the ground that we stand on. It's to me, it's an examination of like why people are the way they are. The characters in the story are all shaped by history in some way. And we come to each other in this moment, and we are, however you would describe it, we are products, we are victims, you know, we are manifestations of all these complex histories. And we just come into intersection with each other, and we have to like deal with all of it, like we do in real life.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, you're an Indigenous actor. I've read half the writer's room on this show is also made up of Indigenous people. That is not the norm. How much do you think that changed what this show could do?
That's not the norm. It's far from it. So by having numerous Indigenous voices from different nations from all over Turtle Island, what the show is able to do is tackle the notion that we are monolithic in any way. Haudenosaunee people are very different than Seminole people, who are quite different than Blackfeet, you know? So when I look at the show, I see families, I see Indigenous families really beautifully wrought and written about. And so for me, that's the benefit of having numerous writers, is that we can create community.
I feel like the jokes are also just really good.
Yeah. The Sierra is a genius, you know, like I tell her that, and she like
one of the showrunners.
Yes,
yeah.
Our showrunner. And she poo-poos me. She goes, no. We're just working. We're worker bees. It's the intelligence. Like, this is a smart show, a really, really smart show. Like, I think humor is awareness, but this show always surprises me with how deep it is.
Yeah, I want to listen to a clip that I think speaks to exactly what you're talking about. This is one of the funniest scenes of the show, I thought. It's at a public event that the mayor is hosting. She's the town's first Black mayor. She's played by Dana L. Wilson. She's a great character. So your character and the mayor have a lot of pretty hilarious and I think super nuanced power struggles. And you can really see it in this scene. The mayor is holding court in front of this group of people. And Terry literally walks up. He has his own mic. He like pulls it out of his pocket and he starts talking in Mohawk. And there are just a couple of English words and the mayor is completely confounded. And I just think it's hilarious.
I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are currently standing on Minnishanka land.
Beautiful. Okay.
What Kwanawaladu? Ayamas Zawadatkalide, Mayor Deirdre Chisenhall Oni. Ayamas Aoganole G Chisenhall. Yaganoa Yungitnagonflatani Nesagane. Unfortunate genocide. Nekchi Nyawanji Dizwe de Gwaliwas Nyeze. Nekchi Ia Mayor Deirdre. Yos Kats Kanigahawe. Your snole on your salade, so frigid.
I mean, partly it's a bummer that you can't see her facial expressions just listening to the audio, because I think that's also partly what makes that scene so great. But I mean, that's hilarious.
It's one of my favorite scenes for like very specific reasons. You nailed it already, is that Dana L. Wilson is a comedy goddess in that scene. her sort of like, first of all, her surprise that I interrupt her speech with my own mic is really so beautiful. And then her growing consternation while at the same time, you know, putting on this smile, like I'm the mayor and this is, I knew we talked about this and this is what was going to happen. And by the end, her defeat, like, she sells every joke line. So Dana is a hero in the scene. But the writing is so brilliant because there's only a few English words peppered into that whole speech, and that's in Mohawk. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Indigenous people all over Turtle Island don't know what we're saying. Only Mohawk speakers would know what I'm saying. So even within our, like in a pan-Indigenous context, we're still, just like everybody else, going, I really want to know what he's saying. Because I think he's trolling her publicly, like right there. And so the entire idea for that joke is housed within an Indigenous ontology, meaning we are the joke writers, we are Indigenous, we're housing this entirely within our points of view, our worldview. Anybody outside of it is going to laugh because they're outside. And I realized when I read that in when we were working on the season, I was like, I've just not seen this. I've not seen a show so unapologetically claim their own space as the center of the narrative. And that's what they did with that speech. I simply applaud that moment. It's actually television history.
Hmm. Oh, that's so cool. So you have had an extensive career in film and TV. You were in True Detective. You've played a number of historical Indigenous men like Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and Tecumseh. This is your first comedy role, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think partly what was such a treat. I mean, I think everyone on this show is incredible, but it seemed to me like you especially were having such a great time in that role.
Best role of my career.
You think so?
Absolutely. Ugh. Absolutely. And it's because I've been really fortunate in the last, I'd probably say about 5-6 years, with the kind of writing that I've been given, the kind of directors I've been working with, you know, the prestige of the various projects. But in no case have I ever been asked to bring so much of myself to a role. Mm-hmm. I think I'm funny. You know, my kids think I'm funny. My wife thinks I'm funny. but people are stunned when they go, you're hilarious. You're like, why haven't you done comedy before? And I'm like, because that's just the way the business works. You know,
because nobody wrote it for you.
Because nobody wrote it for me and nobody saw it that way. And I certainly don't look like I'm, you know, I look the way I look and I play imposing men and or broken men. And mm-hmm. I've loved playing those roles. But Terry isn't broken. He's mm-hmm. ambitious and his life has cohesion and he's happy and he has a lot of joy in his life. And I've not been asked to play joy often.
Mm. Oh, that kind of breaks my heart.
Well, you know what? It's like there, you know, where I'm lucky I have work, you know, like I'm all, you
yeah,
know, I'm,
of
I'm,
course,
you know, I'm a working
course.
Actor, but I think America is quite interesting. Well, they're simply consumed with trauma. So I think there's a tradition of, you know, whether it's cathartic or whatever it is that our communities have been perceived as tragic. Certainly our history is very complex with a lot of trauma. And I think people are comfortable in seeing us or understanding us that way. And Rutherford Falls denies those storytelling tropes again and again.
It really does. So the show isn't only jokes. I'm thinking about the monologue that happens toward the end of episode 4. It's called Terry Thomas, and it's a lot of backstory of your character. At the end, you're in an interview with an NPR reporter. His name is Josh. He's played by Dustin Milligan, who is Ted in Schitt's Creek. There's this moment during the interview when Josh, who it seems like has done his homework, essentially says that the Minnetonka way of life doesn't coincide well, doesn't pair well with capitalism. And Terry reaches over and turns off Josh's recorder and settles down for some real talk.
If we want to ensure this tribe has a successful life, one that can maintain
our traditions, art, and culture, well, it takes power. And unfortunately, power comes from money. The casino is a means to an end. It's the industry of this time. 400 years ago, it was fur trading. 50 years ago, it was manufacturing. And long after I'm dead, there will be Minishanka figuring out how to master the next endeavor. Because that's what we do, Josh. Those of us who fight this battle. We do whatever we have to. I've had to learn to play this game through bare-knuckle necessity. And while it might not make for a feel-good story, I won't rest until my nation gets every single thing that was taken from them.
Ugh, it's chilling.
Yeah.
What was it like to see that in the script?
I was moved to tears when I first read that. That particular speech is, again, landmark. The complexity of language, the complexity of sentence structure is, again, not something given to Native characters in mainstream entertainment. And then he was addressing lots of social, political things. So when I think about that speech, I'm actually, I'm always blown away because there was such rage sitting underneath a lot of that writing, really profound rage, generations of anger, it felt like. And my job was to not capsize that boat. I said recently, you know, that generations ahead of us, they had to eat a lot of shit, grin and bear it for our mm-hmm. sake. And when he turns off the recorder in that speech, he's allowed to speak with an older generation's fury. And then when he's done, he presses the button on the recorder again. And then we see him smile and we see that, you know, that big, huge smile. And like, thank you mm-hmm. so much, Josh. I've enjoyed speaking with you. And then we realize, oh my God.
Yeah.
The double consciousness of people who are in this battle of how we negotiate ignorance, how we negotiate entitlement and privilege is never ending. It's friggin' tiring. But that speech tackles, I mean, a lot of it. And so for me, I'll never forget the moment when I first read it.
It's a profound scene, and it's a gorgeous show. And you have even said how monumental it has been, not only in your own career, but just in terms of you know, representation and having conversations that just have never existed on TV before. Mm. Obviously, I think we also can't like get to a show like Rutherford Falls and then be like, okay, great, we did it. Like, it's done. We fixed it all.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what would you like to see next? Like, what do you think is the next step in making strides forward with when it comes to a show like this and more shows like it?
Well, I think what we've created is a thesis statement with our first season. There is no guarantee that we'll get a second. You know, I think everyone has to understand that the thesis statement we made was our stories, when we're allowed to tell them, are universally appealing. We're funny. We're, you know, there's a beautiful sadness mixed in with our humor. So I argue that we don't know whether we'll get a chance to build on these seasons, this first season of work. So understand, therefore, that this is a precarious position. Reservation Dogs is coming out next. You know, I joke that Rutherford Falls, if we were a band, we would be the Beatles. And Reservation Dogs, they're the Rolling Stones, right? So I love both those bands, right? So mm-hmm. our world is better because they're both in it. So we can't have just one, right? We can't have just two.
We got to get the Who in there. We got to get Pink Floyd.
We got to get the Ramones, you know, the Clash. So, so I hope this is the beginning of a sea change. That's my fervent hope.
I hope so too. I hope we get a season two. And I just really appreciate your time, Michael. This was really a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, Greta, it was my pleasure.
All right. right, that's it for this week. Hope you all have lovely weekends. We will be back next Friday with another episode. In the meantime, you can keep in touch with us on the interwebs. Nerdette is at Nerdette Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. I am at Greta M. Johnson on both Instagram and Twitter. And our producer, Isabel Carter, is on Twitter at Isabel T. Carter. Also, we have a newsletter. You should sign up for it. Every Friday morning, we send over links to cool stuff, things to read or cook or think about or watch. We also put in book club episodes. We have links to some classic eps from the archive. You can sign up for that by going to wbez.org/nerdetteaf. The show is produced by me and Isabel Carter. Our executive producer is Brendan Vanizak. We will see you next week.